All right, we're ready for John chapter 7. This is the outline we're following for our survey through the book, three major sections. There's the public ministry of Jesus, and then there's the private ministry with his immediate disciples in chapters 13 to 17, and then there is the Paschal climax. We are in the first section, the public ministry. Now, like what Baxter has done here, the first signs, the further signs, and the final signs. And in the first signs, here's the witnesses and the context, his initial calling of the disciples, the initial following. And then by chapter 6, the crowds are no longer following him. In the second section, this is where we are. Here we have the witnesses and the conflicts. And we are going to deal with a conflict in chapter 7. Now, and then we'll have this witnesses in the cleavage, meaning that those who cleave after him and follow him. We'll talk about that in chapters 11 and 12. All right, let's review where we've been. Chapter 1, Jesus is the true light, came down from heaven. Chapter 2, power and authority of the Christ. Chapter 3, teacher come from God. Who said that? Not Dennis, but who said? Nicodemus. Nicodemus said that. Why is Nicodemus important for today? All right. Yeah, because he's mentioned at the end of the chapter. That's what we're looking for. All right. Of chapter 7. Chapter 4. Yeah, testimony to the Samaritans and the Galileans. Chapter 5. Yeah, witnesses for Christ as he claimed to be the Son of God. And is there evidence he was a witness? Then he cited four others. Then last week, chapter 6, he is the bread of life as they're following him after feeding the 5,000. All right, question number one is, what's this chapter all about? This is controversy at the Feast of the Tabernacles. Let's talk about the Feast of the Tabernacles just for a moment. This would, if you're keeping up with the time frame, now don't get excited if you're following some study that shifts this by a year or so, because when we come even to the birth of Christ, there's a question whether he was the year that he was born. And then when we come to agreement on that, there is some disagreement on whether or not the feast that's mentioned earlier that we talked about, was it in chapters 5 and 6, what was that, the Passover feast, or was it one of the other feasts? Assuming it's the Passover, and we're going to go with that, we don't know for sure that it was, that would put the date here, and you may have previous notes from previous studies about the fall. This would be in the fall of 29 AD, the events of this chapter. Now, it may have been earlier if you think that was not the Passover that was previously mentioned. Does that make sense? So it depends on determining whether that's the Passover. So that's part of how the chronology is determined of the time. So here in the fall of 29, we're going to have Jesus beginning his latter Judean ministry. He's already done some ministry and work in Judea. He's gone into Galilee. He came back. And he's back in Galilee again. Now he's going to do his latter Judean ministry. Does that make sense? And so John doesn't follow the same format as does the synoptics, that is Matthew, Mark, and Luke, where there is this Galilean ministry, the large segment of that, and then it follows by Judean ministry, etc. But John is indeed unique. So let's talk about this Feast of the Tabernacles. Now I want you to notice that after these things, at verse 1, before we talk about the Feast of the Tabernacles, after these things, Jesus walked in Galilee. That is, after the events of the people turning and walking no more with him, verse 66, he worked in Galilee for a while. And then he comes to the fall of that year at the Feast of the Tabernacles. We know that was in the fall. And we'll say more about that in a moment. But it seems like, if our dating be correct, that John has skipped, and I don't mean that he left some things out that should have been included, because all Gospels don't include all things. But he skipped about 6 months' time, and so there's some things that took place during that time. Remember the story of the Syrophoenician woman? That would have been during this time that's just been skipped. The feeding of the 4,000? That was in this time that was just skipped. The transfiguration, John doesn't talk about that. That was in that time that was just skipped. So from chapter 6, and now we're opening in chapter 7, those are about 6 months period, if our understanding be correct, my understanding, if it's correct, those things just happen. Does that make sense? So it's not that that was supposed to have been included. John just skipped over that for his purpose by inspiration. Now let's talk about the Feast of the Tabernacles. Back, by the way, verse 2 talks about the Feast of the Tabernacles was at hand, and his brothers were encouraging him to go up to the feast. And so here's some controversy at the Feast of the Tabernacles. This started on the 15th day of the 7th month, which was Tishri, which is late September. We'll look at that on a calendar in a second. This was a feast that commemorated the wilderness wanderings. There was a holy convocation or holy assembly on the 1st and on the 8th days. We are familiar with that because we've come through Leviticus and Exodus at the bottom of the screen. There were animal sacrifices. They dwelled in booths, commemorating their remembrance of the wilderness wanderings. There were other activities we'll allude to at verse 37 and 38 and 39 in a moment concerning the use of water. So when did this take place? Well, as you know this calendar, if you've seen this before, our calendar here is January and has come around over here to September. And here is the month of Tishri, and that's the Feast of the Tabernacles, about midway, the 15th of the month. So this would be late September for us. And this is in that fall of 29 AD that these events are taking place. Make sense? All right, here's what happens in chapter 7. There are three things. There was caution in going to the Feast of the Tabernacles. There was controversy while teaching at the Feast of the Tabernacles. And there was concern of the Sanhedrin at the Feast of the Tabernacles. This was very controversial. This is part of that conflict that Baxter put in his outline. Here is the conflict, this controversy at the Feast of the Tabernacles. We all together? All right, let's get a question. Now let's come back to the questions in a minute. Let's talk about this caution in going. There are two things about this caution in going we want to pay attention to. The first is he didn't go openly to the Feast of the Tabernacles. All males were required to go. This is one of the major feasts for the Jews. But he did go, and he went secretly. That is, he didn't go with fanfare and with announcement. And so let's see what happens here. That after these things he walked in Galilee, for he did not walk in Judea because they were seeking to kill him. Why are they seeking to kill him? He is told later in this chapter and in previous chapters. There's a major event. Healing on the Sabbath found in John chapter. Let me give you a hint. It's not chapter 4 and it's not chapter 6. 5. Sharp. You get the smiley face. Yes, John chapter 5. The healing on the Sabbath in John chapter 5, and they sought to kill him because he claimed now to be equal with God. Remember that? Jesus is going to flag that for him here in just a moment. So the Feast of the Tabernacles was at hand. Now let's talk about his brothers here. He stayed in Galilee for a while because they were seeking to kill him. His brothers encouraged him to go to Judea. And so they tell him, depart and go into Judea that your disciples may see the works that you're doing. And if you didn't know any further, sound like they're encouraging him, you need to go and show more signs so more people believe in you. This seems to be in scorn. How do I know? Well, let's jump ahead of ourselves. They didn't believe, according to verse 5. We'll get to that in a second. By the way, his brothers are named in chapter 13 in verse 55 of Matthew. Matthew 13, 55, if you want to flag that. Who were his brothers? They're named, not here, but Matthew 13, 55. You need to go to Judea. You need to go to the land of the Jews to this feast. All the Jews are going to be there. I'm paraphrasing and summarizing. And for no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known openly. You seem to be wanting people to know who you are openly, so why don't you go and declare yourself openly at the Feast of the Tabernacles and show yourself to the world? It seems to be in scorn. Now let's go to verse 5. What does verse 5 tell you? His brothers didn't believe on him. Well, what does that mean? King suggests in his work, that I think it's worth our consideration, that it may mean they just didn't accept that he's the Messiah, that you claim to be the Messiah and they are ridiculing him, and we don't believe you to be the Messiah at all. We don't think you are who you claim to be. But another possibility, King suggests, is that they may believe in him, but they don't believe his timetable, and they don't agree with his timetable, that we think that you are ready to declare yourself to the world. But they're lacking something, either trust in him. If he is the Messiah, then his timetable's got to be right. Wouldn't you agree? If he's deity, whatever timetable he has, it's going to be absolutely on the mark. He didn't miss it by a thousandth of an inch. So they were lacking in trust and confidence in him, to say the least, if not true belief in him. But did they ever become believers? Oh yes, they sure did. Acts 1, you might want to flag Acts 1 and 14. When the disciples continued, the text tells me in Acts 1, 14 that his brothers were included in that. And by the way, they hold a prominent place in the New Testament. You remember the book of James, written by one of his brothers. Remember the book of Jude, written by one of his brothers. They're in this crowd, right here in this text. People can change. Make sense? One writer observed this: it's not unusual for those who serve the Lord faithfully to find the most intense opposition among their own relatives. So says Woods. That's a good point. When you decide you're going to do what's right and you're going in the right direction, you may find the greatest opposition within your own circle. And Jesus found that here. All right. With that in mind, verses 6 to 9, Jesus said his time had not yet come. So let's see what he says, and then let's see what talk about what that may mean. He said, "My time is not yet come, but your time is always ready." Well, on the surface, that we may not understand. In fact, he didn't tell us what his time is here. It's interesting, this is the same phrase he used in speaking to his own mother. Remember that in chapter 2 and verse 4? When she wanted him to work a miracle, his mother was wanting him to work, and he did ultimately work a miracle, but when she brought the problem of the lack of running out of wine, he told her, "My time has not yet come." And he tells his brothers that. Apparently they're on a different timetable than him. Now he said, "The world cannot hate you, but it hates me." And we're going to come back to verse 6, so don't get excited. Because I testify that its works are evil. There's something about my time has not yet come and the evil in the world and the world hating him. And in this context, he talks about they seek to kill me. That's why he's not going up there just yet. Let's go ahead and get verse 8 and 9, then we'll talk about what that means. He said, "You go to the feast," but I'm not going to the feast yet. Well, he says, "I'm not going." The word yet's been supplied. But I think that's what he means, and that's why it's been supplied. Because my time is not fully come. And when he said these things, he remained in Galilee. So what does he mean, my time hadn't yet come? Yeah, it's not time for me to go to Jerusalem. If they're setting out to kill him, he comes in with the great fanfare and with the announcement and the honor of being a king, and they then kill him. His time for his final declaration and his sacrifice is not yet. That's coming later. There's more work to do. So God has a different timetable than man. It seems like his mother thought it's time for let everybody know. His brothers, let's go. And you show who you are, if that's who you are, or we believe who you are, but it's now time to make declaration of that. Whatever the case may be, he's saying, my time hadn't come. It's not time for me to rush into Jerusalem with fanfare and with declaration. I'm going to go, but I'm not going to go with you, and I'm going to get there. You just go on. Does that make sense? My time for full declaration has not yet come. There's other things to do. God has a different timetable. Sometimes we want to rush God, and this is an example here of some patience. Let's go to 10 to 13. He did go in secret. Verse 10 says that he did go, but not with his brothers, but he went as if it were in secret. Didn't tell us how he traveled, didn't tell us how he entered, or when he entered, and who he was with. Was he alone? Just says he went there and suddenly he's there, as if he were in secret. Now when the people are expecting him at the feast, are they not? Because now at verse 11, they're starting to ask, where is he? In other words, I know he's going to be here. They hadn't forgot about the controversy earlier. They hadn't forgot about, we sought to kill him and he got away from us and we didn't lay hands on him and we're looking for him, and if we find him, we're going to do something. We're going to seize him. That's the idea. And there was much murmuring. And what was the argument in verse 12? All right, some were saying he's a good man. Look at verse 12. Some were saying that he's good. So I don't know what all the murmuring, all the complaining, all the questions are about. He's a good man. And others were saying, no, he deceives the people. Well, that's the only two alternatives. That's a pretty good proposition. Either Jesus is who he claims to be, or he's a liar. There is no such thing as he's not who he claims to be, but he's a good man. He claims to be the Messiah. He claims to be deity. He claims to be God. And if that's not who he is, then he's a liar. And he's one of the worst frauds there has ever been on the earth. And that's a pretty good proposition that they've laid out. However, what's the however, verse 13? Yeah, they're those that are supportive of him and those who have seen his miracles and those who are believers in him are not ready to open up and say, I'm looking for him and I'll find him because I believe in him and I have confidence in him and I've seen his miracles. They're not going to openly say that because they have some fear of the Jews. So here's the point that we're learning here. He went cautiously to the Feast of the Tabernacles. He didn't go openly, but he went in secret. Questions or comments on his manner of going? Now we have a series of six things that happen here in a moment in the reaction. But verse 14 says, when he got there, and now that he's there in their midst, what does he start doing in the temple? Yeah, he went to the temple and he taught. And so here is public declaration. He knows there's going to be controversy. What's he teaching? I'm not sure. But something that he said brought some reaction from the Jews. So beginning at verse 15, and here's where we go to question number. Question number three. How did the Jews react to Jesus' teaching in the temple? What'd you say, Dennis? They're astonished. Amazed at what he knew, how much he knew, and how he knew that. What else? How did he know this? They asked him a question. The question was, who seeks to kill you? Did they not ask that? Yeah, they ask that. Who seeks to kill you? What else in this reaction? Verse 25, there's another reaction they had. They're not only amazed at his teaching, they're also amazed that he is... Yeah, how's he getting away with this? They're looking for this man, and he's up here teaching, and how's he getting away with this? Let's work through all of that. Let's talk about the Jews' reaction. All right, here's the reaction to his teaching and the reply Jesus gave. The first one is at verse 15. You might want to flag these depending on whether you want to call some of them a reaction or just what they did. But anyway, here's their reaction in verse 15. How does this man know letters having never studied? In other words, he didn't go to our schools, our rabbinical schools. We know something of his background. He wasn't schooled in the law. He's not a scribe. He is not a rabbi in the sense that he was schooled and formally trained. So how does he know all of this about the Old Testament and quoting and citing and teaching, having never studied? How in the world does he do that? And so what was the answer Jesus gave? My doctrine is not mine, but his who sent me. So my doctrine's not my own, but I'm teaching the doctrine of God. So that's how I know, number one. Now then, he assures them of something. This is a powerful verse, verse 17. You need to mark. What do you learn from 17 and 18? You can know, just paraphrase it, just put it in simple terms. He's saying to them, you can know if I am teaching the truth. You can know that. We'll get back to that in a moment. Whether I speak of myself or my own authority. He who speaks for himself seeks his own glory. But he who seeks the glory of the one who sent him is true, and no unrighteousness is in him. So what's he saying? He's saying, you can know if I speak the truth or not. So you want to know how I know this? Well, I know this from God because God has given this to me. I'm speaking the mind of God is what I'm doing. But you can know whether I know that I'm speaking the truth or not. I'm going to come back to verse 17. Let's go and tie verse 19 with it. His point in verse 19, did not Moses give you the law? And yet none of you keeps the law. Why do you seek to kill me? In other words, he is convicting them of the charge that they're trying to level against him. They had said he's violated the law. The Sabbath was violated back over here in John chapter 5. That's why we want to kill him. He's violated the law, and we want to kill him for that. And he's charging them, you have no respect for the law. Did not Moses give you the law, and yet you don't keep the law? He's going to give them evidence of that. You don't keep the law, and yet you seek to kill me. Why do you seek to kill me? Well, that prompts another question. Let's go back to 17 now. So what's the assurance? I may have asked a question on this. Let me see if I did or not. If not, I don't see that. Verse 17 is giving assurance to what? Say again. All right, inspiration of the Old Testament, that's true. Absolutely. All right, both statements are true. That's what I'm fishing for. If anyone wants to do his will, he shall know concerning the doctrine. I'm convinced this passage teaches that if a person has a desire to see the truth, they can and they will see the truth. Sometimes they see it and then rebel against it. But you say, well, I don't understand. People are so confused and the truth is just so hard for them to grasp. If a person really has a desire to know what's right, they will see the truth. I'm convinced that assures us of that. And so we just teach the gospel, and if the people have the right heart, they'll accept the truth. If they don't, they won't accept it, and that's just the way it is. The gospel does its work. Sometimes it turns people away. Sometimes it attracts people. And so when people turn and walk no more with him, John 6:66, so be it. When people then come because they're attracted to the truth, so be it. Just teach the truth. Power of the gospel. Flag that verse because, you know, that person that's your friend, your neighbor, your relative that you're wanting to teach the gospel and you've been working on that and you say they have a hard time and I don't understand why they can't see the truth. If they really want to know the truth, they'll see the truth. Sometimes people don't want the truth. They want it to please them. All right, now let's pick up at verse 20. The next thing they ask him is, who seeks to kill you? In other words, who's out to do that? Kind of wink, wink. Not me. What's his answer? It's because I did one work, one miracle, and you all marvel. What miracle are they talking about? Healing on the Sabbath, John 5. Might flag John 5 in the margin if you don't have that. Now he illustrates something with Moses. Moses gave you command to circumcise, though it's not from Moses. They talked about it being from Moses. But actually, it was to the fathers, Genesis 17, before Moses came along. And you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. And if a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath so that the law is not broken, you're angry when I make a man completely well. So what's his point? Absolutely. You're not judging things properly. And we'll get to that in verse 24. He's saying, when you try to keep the law, you try to do what you think you're supposed to do, which is right, you're to circumcise on the eighth day, sometimes the eighth day is going to fall on the Sabbath. So what do? They circumcise on the Sabbath. Do you think that's working? Do you think that's a violation of the law? No. You recognize that there are some things that are not a violation of the law, and healing is not a violation of the law either. And so he deals with their inconsistency. So you want to know who seeks to kill me? You're seeking to kill me because I worked one miracle on the Sabbath, which was not a violation of the Sabbath, no more than when you circumcise on the Sabbath. You circumcise, and I make a man well on the Sabbath, and y'all think I violated the Sabbath, but you're okay. So then he adds, judge according, not to appearance, but according to righteous judgment. Not according to how it looks superficially or according to man's tradition. Healing on the Sabbath was a violation of their tradition, but wasn't a violation of the law. Does that make sense? There's some things that may just, this doesn't look right. But if it doesn't violate the law of God, it's not sin. Does that make sense? And so judge, not according to appearance, but judge righteous judgment in harmony with the righteousness of God. Does that make sense? All right. Move on to the next reaction. Number three. Is this the one they seek to kill? This is at verse 25. He speaks boldly and nothing is done. And we know where this man is from, but we will not know where the Messiah is from. And I'm paraphrasing that, of course. And so this is the one they're after to kill, and nothing is being done. And notice the question is, do the rulers know indeed that this is truly the Christ? It seems to be in ridicule of Jesus. And or it could be asking that they could be asking, have the rulers fallen for this too? In other words, why aren't they doing something? Have some of the rulers fallen for this deception, and they think he's... Is that what's going on? And we know where he's from, but we don't know where the Messiah is from. Were they right about that? We don't know where the Messiah would be from. Exactly. The Old Testament had said he'd be born in Bethlehem, be of Nazareth. Remember that? They didn't know where he's from. They were ignorant of the scriptures is what was going on. So Jesus said, you know me and where I'm from. But what else does he say in answer to this? Yeah. You don't know the Father. Look at verse 28b. But he who sent me, whom you do not know, I know him, for I am from him. And I'm saying, I came from God. That's where I came from. But you don't know the Father. You claim to know the Father, but you don't know the Father. You say you don't know me. You do know who I am and where I'm from. And you don't know the Father. That's where the problem is. You don't know God, the Father, like I do, because I came from God. Well, let's speed up the pace a little bit. Verse 30, they were seeking to kill him. They're going to take him by force. That's what they try to do. Verse 31, some people believed, pointing to the signs. And there's something about what he's doing makes them think of the signs the Messiah would perform. And the question is, will he, when the Christ or the Messiah come, will he do more signs than this man is doing? If he's not the Messiah, I can't imagine the Messiah doing more than this. And so they point to the end with the signs. Then the sixth thing, I said there were six. So at 32 to 36, they sent officers to seize him and to go take him. And so what did Jesus say to them? I'm going to go away. And where I'm going... You're not going to get, you won't come. And they thought he's talking about and so as the Jews have dispersed into the Greek society, that's what he's talking about. He's going to hide among the Greeks. And is that what he's talking about? Where does he think he's going that we can't find him? And he's speaking of his ascension, resurrection and ascension into heaven. They don't understand that. All right. Now let's talk about this section. This is a difficult section, at least it is for me, and it may be for you as well. It's a simple point couched in some difficult language, I think. Let's get the simple point first, and then we'll come back to the difficult language and how we get back to the simple point. I think what he's talking about is that you come to me and you can have salvation. And those who receive salvation, particularly the apostles in this context, are going to take the message of salvation to the world. That's pretty simple. That's what happened in Acts 2, isn't it? That's what he's talking about. And I'll tell you how I think I know that. Let's talk about a little background information here. Most of your commentators will flag this for you, that each day during the Feast of the Tabernacles, there was a procession of people who would take a golden pitcher to the pool of Siloam and dip water out of the pool and carry that to the temple and pour it on the altar. Now this is the Feast of the Tabernacles was a remembrance and a commemoration of their wilderness wanderings. And one of the things that happened during the wilderness wanderings was they became thirsty and God gave them water from a rock on two occasions. You remember that? And so this is part of that commemoration of God giving us and giving us water. And this is also a time in our late September for them in Tishri was a time when the period was dry and it was hot. So with that going on and on their mind, Jesus said, and he cried out saying, if anyone thirst, let him come to me and drink. Y'all got thirst on your mind. You remember thirsting in the wilderness and remembering that? You come to me and I'll give you to drink. Same thing he said in John 4, same principle of John 6. Making sense? All right. Then he says, he who believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of him flows the rivers of living water. Probably alluding to Isaiah 58, 11, Psalm 36, 8 and 9, Zechariah 14, 8, Ezekiel 47, 1, just among a few. There's some others that go along that line. Are they all talking about the same thing? Not exactly, but it's the idea. And I think that's talking about there's a fountain of blessings flowing forth unto others. That's what the context, without going back to those passages I just cited, had reference to. So I'm convinced that verse 37 is talking about coming to him for salvation, and it's like drinking the water and you'll never thirst, like John 4. Where verse 39 is talking about the work of the apostles carrying that message forth, and that becomes a flowing of blessings out unto others. You say, how do you know that's what verse 38 is about? Because we have a divine commentary. This is John's commentary by inspiration at verse 39. But this he spoke concerning the Spirit, whom those believing in him would receive, for the Holy Spirit had not yet been given because Jesus has not been glorified. Now you tie that with Acts 1, the Spirit was going to come after he ascended into heaven. And it came upon the apostles, Acts 2, 1. Remember that? So I think we have to distinguish between the water to be received for salvation. It's not literal water. That's talking about receiving salvation like drinking water, verse 37. And the water that flows in blessings unto others, which had to do with the work of the Spirit. And we know from history, Acts 2, through the rest of the book of Acts, coming upon the apostles, the miracles they worked in carrying out the message of the gospel. The Holy Spirit fell upon them and guided them in what they preached and taught. Now, I know that fits history. There's nothing incorrect. Is that what this is talking about? I think so. Maybe talking about something else, but I think that's what that's talking about. Now, what I just presented is true facts, but does that fit this? You'll have to decide. Make sense? I know that's what happened in Acts 2. I know that's exactly what happened in Acts 2, and you know that as well. All right. Now, let's go to verse 40. We got a lot to cover, and we've only got about 4 minutes, so let's see if we can do that. 40 to 44, some believed and some did not. So here we are still at the Feast of the Tabernacles. He's teaching, and some said that truly this is the prophet. What prophet? We flag this, so we ought to know this. One that was spoken by Moses in Deuteronomy 18. Very good. Deuteronomy 18. That God would raise up a prophet like unto him. Some said, this is that prophet. And others said, this is the Christ, the Messiah. And others said, will the Christ come out of Galilee? I mean, I'm not sure this is the Christ because he didn't come out. Has not the scripture said he would be of the seed of David, born of the Bethlehem where David was? Well, that was true. But then they went to Nazareth and he was out of Nazareth. So there was division among the people. And some wanted to take him, but no one laid hands on him. So some believed and some didn't is the point I want us to see. Let's talk about the concern of the Sanhedrin to wind up here. The officers come back and report to the Sanhedrin court. And they want to know, verse 32 is where they sent him. So did you get him? And they said, no one ever spoke like this man. They were so awed at his teaching, they couldn't lay hands on him. That's a whole sermon. Every preacher's got a sermon. No one spake like this man. He didn't speak like the rabbis. He didn't speak like the scribes. They didn't speak with authority. They could just tell you what the law said. He speaks as if he's behind the law because he was. He's the fulfillment of the prophecy because he was. Then the Pharisees, are you also deceived? Have any of the rulers of the Pharisees believed in him? What they may be saying is there's no prominent person. Y'all are a bunch of idiots is what they're probably saying to these officers. Y'all must be some dumb nuts and idiots because there's not any prominent person that believes in him. None of the rulers believe in him. There's none of them. But you seem to have fallen for this. And so it's a put down and a ridicule of them. Now, at verse 50, Nicodemus, we flagged him earlier. He's the one that came to Jesus by night, being one of them. He's a member of the Sanhedrin court. What did he say? He seems to be, and we'll get to this later in the book of John, so we'll hold this for, I believe, chapter 19. He seems to be like Joseph of Arimathea, a secret disciple. And I'll give you some evidence what I think of that, why I think that later in John 19. But he seems to be a secret disciple who has some admiration for him. He came to Jesus and said, no one can do the miracles that you do except God be with him. So he has some confidence in Jesus. He defends him here is the point I'm trying to make. And he's a member of the Sanhedrin court. And we need to judge him fairly. You don't judge a man until you've heard him in court. So let's not condemn him just yet. And then someone said at verse 52, no prophet came out of Galilee. Is that correct? No, that's not correct. Well, because Jesus was out of Galilee. But Jonah, 2 Kings 14:25, came out of Galilee. They didn't know their Old Testament history. So that was incorrect. Here's something I'm learning. Quite often, those who make assumptions and make arguments make it on misinformation. And they were doing the same thing. All right, and then finally, verse 53 may be set off to itself and you kind of miss it because they group it with chapter 8 in some translations that everyone went to their own house. In other words, they didn't take him. How that was put off, some commentators talk about, we're not told how God did that, but God's putting off, they're seizing him just yet, not quite ready for that. I'm going to leave you with that. You can look at some of those practical things that you learned, and we're going to stop right there, chapter 8 next time.